March 1st, 2013. This is an interview with Rick Deluge. Is that how you say your last name, Rick?
That's correct.
Okay. We are here at Union South as part of the Academic Staff Institute's effort to collect oral histories with academic staff members. I am Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Archives, their oral history program. Rick, for recording purposes, could you say your name and then spell your last name?
Rick Deluge, D-A-L-U-G-E.
Okay, I'm going to slide this just a little bit towards you. I may have to speak up a little bit, so I'm not yelling at you. I'm just trying to make sure my questions get heard.
Correct.
Rick, you are, as we said, and as we know before we started recording, that you are a longtime member of the UW-Madison campus, even before it was UW-Madison. It was just UW.
I came here in 1967 for my undergraduate degree. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, my mother had gone to school here and gotten her bachelor's degree here in home economics. Otherwise, I'm sure that my parents probably wouldn't have let me come here at that time with all of the Dow Chemical riots and mm-hmm. TA strikes and Vietnam War protests and everything else that was going on at the time. But I had a strong affinity for the campus because I'd been in summer music clinics. I'd been in 4-H conferences that were held here. And so I knew the campus pretty well before I actually got here as a mm-hmm. student. And I didn't know what I wanted to major in initially, so I started out in ag education, which is a nice general kind of major. I had a high school ag teacher my senior year that graduated from here, and I kind of was intrigued by him and his teaching style. So I went into ag education. Lived in Adams Hall my freshman year, joined Alpha Gamma Rho fraternity, which still exists here on campus. It's an agricultural social professional fraternity, and finished my degree and applied for a few teaching jobs, and actually did my student teaching at Janesville Parker underneath my old high school teacher, which was kind of an interesting experience. Looked at teaching jobs in southern Wisconsin. Nothing was popping out at that time. 1971, economy wasn't the best. There weren't tons of jobs out there for people in agriculture. And Extension had an opening for a 4-H and youth agent in Buffalo County, Wisconsin. So I trekked up to Buffalo County, did an interview, and ended up getting that offer. And my significant other at the time was working for the Brown Swiss Association in Beloit, and so I had to convince her to quit her job and move up to Elma, Wisconsin. So we did that for about a year and a half in Buffalo County, and then a job opened up in the College of Ag and Life Sciences in the dean's office, and they had just started an alumni association for the College of Ag, and I thought, well, that was a great idea, and I quickly joined it as a charter member. Little did I realize that I, 6 months later, I would be the guy that was shepherding the organization through its formative stages. So we moved back to Madison October or November of 72, and began work in the dean's office, and my initial responsibilities were to serve as the secretary treasurer of the Ag Alumni Association, and also to be sort of a recruitment officer for the college and do student career services job placement. At that time it was called job placement, and now it's career services.
Right.
So did that initially for the first 10 years or so that I was here on campus.
Okay. I want to ask a couple of follow-up questions about that before we talk about the farm and industry.
Yep.
Short course. So as we mentioned before we turned on the recorder, and you alluded to it, that you came to campus as an undergrad during some, I think we can use the word tumultuous to describe them. You must have did undergrad from about 67 through either 70 or 71.
71.
Which means basically from Dow Riot through the Sterling Hall bombing.
Correct.
When you came here, what was your impression of the war in Vietnam?
Well, I don't know that there was anybody that really wanted to be drafted and go to the war. And so that was one big incentive for people to come here and do well academically, because if they didn't, their local draft board would grab them and they would go to Vietnam. And that shadow hung over me until my junior year, when they came out with the first lottery, where we relied on luck. And I was truly, truly lucky, because my birth date was number 364. So once that was drawn, there was no chance that I would be drafted. I think, initially when I first got here, I probably wasn't thinking too much about whether the war was a good thing or a bad thing. A lot of college students, to some extent at that time, there was a lot of fun and games going on, they missed classes, they protested on a regular basis. There was a group of people that, threw rocks at police cars and, this kind of thing. Police, I think, were a little bit overreactive at the time. I mean, they would, I was in the university band and was also in the marching band. When you'd walk down State Street with your instrument case, they would stop you to look, make you open it, because they were afraid there was a bomb inside. So there was a lot of, there was tear gas thrown into fraternity houses, and quite frankly, the fraternity house people were not the people that were probably doing all of the demonstrating and rioting. It was like an indiscriminate, the police looked at it as it was us against the world, and they didn't really care. They just thought there's a bunch of college kids here and we gotta keep them under control. At least that's my impression of kind of what was going on. I think after the Sterling Hall bombing, things really settled down in a fast hurry, because I don't think anybody really wanted people to get killed in this process. Mm-hmm. Of course, then working in student recruitment, when I came back to campus, I was really glad things had settled down, because it was really difficult to convince a lot of parents of rural Wisconsin kids to come to study at Madison because of what had all gone on here. But there were a lot of things. I was pretty active in student government at the time. I was the president of our Ag Council on the Ag campus. And there were decisions that the faculty had to make about, are we going to, because of the TA strike, are we going to have classes pass-fail? And, in the Ag College, well, basically most of our classes weren't affected by the TA strike. We didn't have many TAs. Most of them met regularly anyway. So I had the opportunity to stand up in front of the faculty of the Ag College and say that the students pretty much wanted to be graded, not to get a pass for their courses. Mm-hmm. And we all had enough passes on our record from LNS and mm-hmm. education and other parts of the campus. So it was an interesting time, and I have pretty vivid memories of a lot of it yet, and people, demonstrators coming in, taking over a class, mm-hmm. and escorting the professor off the stage, or off the podium, mm-hmm. It was. I think some of the people that were leading some of those things didn't really think through what they were doing that much. But it was like they wanted to shut the whole campus down, essentially. I remember in the Stock Pavilion, for instance, that's where the National Guard troops were stationed to basically keep order on campus. Mm-hmm. And they would come out of there with their jeeps and trucks, every morning on a regular basis. So it was quite an interesting time to be on campus, mm-hmm. and National Guardsmen, in front of all the buildings, they were there to try to let the students into the classrooms and keep the TA strikers out, and mm-hmm. or the demonstrators out, whatever the case might be.
So you get to see, it sounds like you got to see a balance, and by balance I mean that the classes you took in what's now called CALS, but Ag and Life Science, perhaps were not as tumultuous as the classes you would take
right.
from LIS, or what we now call lower campus.
Right. I remember, I mean, we all, you know, most of us that went to college someplace always have this reoccurring nightmare that we're, we dream that we missed a class for the whole semester, and my God, I got to take the final exam or whatever. Forgot they were enrolled in it or whatever it might be. I still have those dreams. But actually, it actually happened. I had an education professor. It was a course in recreation resource management, and he had told us when the TA strike began that his class would no longer meet. And you have to remember there was no email in those days. Communication was simply, it was pretty much by letter or by phone call. So I took him literally at his word that this class wouldn't meet until the strike was over. Went back to class when the strike was over, and he said, "Where have you been for the last 6 weeks?" And the class had started meeting, but I didn't know about it. And so we had a final exam out on the lawn of Bascom Hill, because obviously I did not get all the material that was covered in the class. And I mean, as a consumer, you know, I look back on that and I say, well, I got screwed, you know. Mm-hmm. That was a bad situation. But, you know, at the time, I think as students, it was more just frustration, you know. Well, you know, God, the guy started teaching the class and didn't, didn't tell all of us about it. So, I had experiences on all fronts, I think. I think, you know, I was living with a group of relatively conservative folks, but I would say you couldn't really say that there was really anybody that was terribly conservative on campus in those days, mm-hmm. but there were varying degrees
right. of that. Now, the Sterling Hall bombing happened a few weeks before classes started. So were you on or near campus in August of 1970?
I was not on campus at that point, but got here shortly thereafter.
Okay. Did you, out of curiosity or whatever reason, sort of take a look around once you got here to see the damage?
Well, that end of Sterling Hall, there was quite a bit of damage, and obviously enough damage to kill a person who was working in his lab. The interesting thing about that story was that that researcher's Fosnick, I believe was his name. His daughter came through the College of Ag and Life Sciences. He had a daughter, an infant daughter at the time, and she ended up being a student in our college years mm-hmm. later. I think a lot of the rubble, initial rubble, was pretty well cleaned up by the time I got back on campus.
All right,
but it was really was enough of a shock though that I think it. Really settled things down quite a bit here on campus.
Yeah, my guess is that your last, so that probably would have been the start of your senior year, that year wasn't nearly as tumultuous as the other three.
That's correct.
Rick, let's talk about, unless there's something else sort of on your mind.
Well, I should say that when I was in the marching band during that time period, first of all, nobody wanted to be in the marching band very much, and we had on the first year that Mike LaCrone came here, he was my band director my junior year, there were only 96 people that marched, all men, because it was only men in the marching band at that time, and we had gone 3 years before we won a football game, and so you can see it was not a popular thing to be doing on a Saturday afternoon was, mm-hmm. was sitting in Camp Randall and watching a football team play that couldn't win anything. So just a little aside.
Right, and what I've heard from others is that regardless of the uniform, it really wasn't a good time to be wearing a uniform on campus.
Exactly. Nobody, I don't think anybody really looked up to people. And then, of course, when Mike LaCrone came here, he had a butch haircut. He came from Indiana, mm-hmm. conservative as could be, and first thing he said to people, he said, "You got to cut your hair. It's got to be above the collar of your uniform." 20 guys said, "Well, I'm not going to do that." They quit. Mm-hmm. And then he said, "You're going to have to pick your feet up in the air." And we had not been a real high-stepping band before that. and another 20 people quit. And then he said, we're going to do a run-on. We're going to run onto the field at pregame, and which is what they still do today. You know, another 20 people said, we're not going to do that. So that's one reason why the numbers got down there as low as they did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took a couple of years, but his system started working and people changed. And
right.
Now there's a waiting list, so.
Yeah. And it sounds like from what you just said, too, that, you were in the marching band, so you sort of had no choice but to go to the games, but it wasn't as, athletics wasn't as big a business and as well attended.
Not at all. They had just built the upper deck, and they had probably a third of it filled. Pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
I look at pictures from that stadium and from that era, then, you know, I think that there maybe was 40,000 people total at the games, so pretty small.
Mm-hmm. Times have changed. So let's talk about the associate dean / director of the farm and industry short course.
Okay.
So how did that? Let's define our terms, because you know who knows who's going to listen to this. What is the farm and industry short course?
Well, the farm and industry short course is a pretty unique program, unique nationally actually. When land grant colleges were started back in 1862, they were supposed to teach agriculture, and we had a situation where we weren't getting anybody to come to study agriculture because most of the farmers only had like an eighth grade education. Most of them saw no benefit to getting a bachelor's degree. So in 1885, Dean Henry decided he would offer a 12-week winter course in agriculture for farmers, young farmers. And the program became wildly successful, and by the late 1890s and early 1900s, they had like 400 students in the program, and it took until the 1930s for the 4-year program to catch up enrollment wise with the short course. So and they offered a variety of courses, and some of the titles of the courses are not much different today, but what we're teaching is a whole lot different than what they taught back in the 1880s. The gist of the program was that, have the students come to study when they can't do any farm work. And that's probably why this program has survived when many, many other ones around the country have not, because we have stuck to the schedule of this winter time frame. It's been expanded to about 15 weeks now, and we offer a couple 1-week sessions. So a student could be here for, say, 17 weeks, probably maximum. But that's a semester of college. They pay now the same fees that a student in the 4-year program pays for a semester. They can come back 2 years to the program now. And originally it was a 1-year program, then it grew into a 2-year program, and then the time went from 12 weeks to 15 weeks. But the other land-grant colleges that had similar type programs, a lot of them have gone by the wayside. There's a few that morph them into more of a full-year program. Michigan State has a program where the students start in September, just like all the rest of the students do. And then they finish in mid-March, but they require them all to do an internship. And then they do that for the next 2 months until May. But a lot of their students are in the horticultural kind of industry, the landscape horticulture area. And that works out great because that's when all those jobs come open, and it's pretty easy to get an internship and work in that particular area. Mm-hmm. With our situation, most of the dairy farmers wanted their sons and daughters back home again, by the end of March to
right.
to help.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been it's a unique program. Purdue had a program that was an 8-week session, and that was dropped about 10 years ago. But they all a lot of these ag colleges started out with programs like our short course, but very few. In fact, I don't think there's any that exist exactly like that anymore.
So how did you then become involved in the leadership of?
Well, I applied for the job. When it came open, Leo Walsh was the dean of the college at the time. And I had obviously worked with some of these students when I was doing job placement, because I'd helped them find jobs, and I knew a fair amount about the program, and then I knew a lot of the alumni because I had been working with the alumni program. And so I applied for the job and ended up, you know, getting the job, and I was 34 years old at the time. It was a little bit raucous of a group of people at that time. The students, it was 18-year-old drinking age on campus. These kids come off the farm, and they wanted to have a good time. And back in those early 80s, farmers had a fair amount of money, and economy was pretty good for the farm economy. The bottom started falling out of that farm economy in about 84, 85, right about the year of the centennial. I remember we were talking about it, and we said, gosh, here we were having the centennial, the short course, and the ag economy is just horrible. And there were several government programs, you know, where they were taking land out of production and things like this. So the first few years I was in the program, the enrollment dropped fairly drastically. From about 200 students down to about 140, 150, something like that. And it really was the economy more than anything else that was affecting it. And then we also had a declining enrollment of students graduating from high school. And, you know, those numbers have big impacts on all university and college enrollments. If you don't have enough kids in the pipeline, you know, it's pretty hard to keep your enrollment up. So that continued. There was a decline all the way until about 93, 94. We were down to about 90 students in the program. And there was questions whether this should continue or not. But then we could see that the numbers were, you know, coming through high school, were going to start going back up again. And you know, now I think the last several years they've been running an enrollment of about between 125 and 135 students pretty regularly. But the big changes, I guess, from when I started. Number one, in 83, we were just starting to use microcomputers, they called them. Most of the students coming through the program those first 3 or 4 years I was working with it had no computer background, no knowledge about computers, because they hadn't taught it in high school. So it was trying to teach them about computers, what a computer could do. And it was the old DOS system, you know, and the big floppy disks. And it you know, so a huge change in technology in terms of email and, you know, just use of computers for so many things in the time that I was director. The other big change, of course, was that we had a lot more women students that have joined into the program. When I started, I think we used to have 8 or 10 women, and now I think they're up around about 25-30% of the attendees are women. So pretty big change in that regard. Of course, the drinking age changed to 19 and then to 21, and that definitely reduced the party atmosphere because it wasn't legal to do this kind of thing anymore. So that tends to change things a little bit. Scholarship support for this program has always been extremely strong. You know, because a lot of the employers in agriculture like this type of person, even though 60% of them go back to their home farms, there's still a lot of demand for the students that come out of the program. So I don't know. You probably have some questions at this point.
I do. How do you think the change in technology? What were the pros and cons, if there were either, of the sort of the rise of technology over the 30 or so years that you were director?
Well, I think with all college students, as they have gotten more used to their telephones, their cell phones, and email, there's been a decline in some of the personal interaction between faculty and students, because I come to class, but more things are done using technology, both from the instructor's standpoint as well as the student's standpoint. So you don't maybe see the students face-to-face as much, or you don't get the questions face-to-face that you used to get, but you get more emails than before. But on the other hand, I mean, technology in agriculture has grown by leaps and bounds. I mean, when we first came out with global positioning systems using farm machinery and using various fields to determine how much fertilizer to apply based on the previous production records, that kind of technology was, you know, initially we taught 1 week classes on that because people weren't aware of it. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, then they became very aware of it because they all have it. So it's technology is just something that's there and going to keep on getting better. But I look back on what we tried to do initially, and oh my goodness, what a struggle! Right. Because they, you know, and I can also recall, I grew up on a dairy farm. My younger brother still runs the dairy farm, and I remember saying to students, well, you know, you really should look at getting a milking parlor, or getting a free stall housing where your cows are free to come and go wherever, whenever they want. Oh no, you can't take care of cows that way. All these students would say, you know, this was back in the 80s, you can't take care of cows that way. They have to be in a stanchion barn where you can see them every day and several times a day, and you know them, you know every one of them. And you know, now they're doing all kinds of that kind of thing. You know, they've all converted to milking parlors and freestall barns, but initially back in the 80s, you know, well, you can't do something like that. You can't take care of your cows that way. So that it's always a mindset, you know. Now the big lot of students have gone into organic, trying to get their farms to be certified organic, right. Things like that.
Let me hit pause and just, I want to tell her that we still have a few. All right, we're back. So I'm interested in, I'm always interested in the idea of a typical day because there's really no such thing. But so while the course is going on as AD/director, what are the types of things you're doing?
Well, it would vary a little bit between whether this was at, you know, the beginning of the program or closer to the end of it. But initially, I used to advise all the students, the first 6 weeks they were here, I would try to get them all in for a 30-minute appointment to talk to them about what other courses they were going to take the next two terms in the program, what their future plans were, if they were going to go back farming, if they're going to be looking for a job. Try to talk a little bit about their farming situation, get some sense of what they wanted to get out of this program while they were here. And part of my rationale was, well, you know, they're paying the same tuition everybody else is, and everybody else gets an advisor, and they needed an advisor as well. Mm-hmm. So that was, I spent a lot of time the first 6 weeks of the program just talking to the students. But I also operated the two dormitories that the Ag College owns where these students reside. I had to hire and work with six house fellows, a couple custodians, a couple office staff people. So there never was a dull moment, let's put it that way, because there was always, you know, there might be some issues that came up in the dormitory, or we were looking at remodeling or doing some major project, putting in new windows and new electrical systems and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I would say then as the term went along, you know, then you started working on the next year's class and, you know, recruiting students. We'd have visit days where students would come in and take a look at the program. and visit some classes, see what was going on. Mm-hmm. We'd also do had to work with the scholarship program, get students lined up for the various scholarships for the next year. At the same time, thank the current scholarship donors. Start looking at the students as they got closer to graduation. Did they have all the requirements that they had to have? Was their GPA good enough to actually graduate from the program? And sometimes it wasn't. That was another thing. I guess when I started there, I discovered that they hadn't enforced any real academic standards. So one of the reasons some of these kids thought this was, you know, a vacation from the farm was because there wasn't any requirement that they had to get a certain GPA to stay in school. So we basically implemented the same kind of grade point requirements that the four-year program requires. We also implemented a honors system, so the students can take courses for honors credit if they wish, and they can graduate with honors, pretty much the same kinds of things that there are in the bachelor's degree program. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't in place when I started. Basically, if the student came and they took all the classes that they were supposed to take, whether they failed them or got A's in them, they still could graduate. And we changed that. And that helped put a little bit more dedication into the students, I think, because there was a requirement. And some of the students clearly didn't belong here. They shouldn't have been here. And this way, after 6 weeks, that we could tell them that, you know, you probably should go home because this isn't for you. The program has always been an open admission program from the earliest days, back when the Regents said all you got to have is an eighth grade education to come. And we tried to find, you know, where, if there was any, you know, rules on any of this that had carried forward. Because obviously most of the students had a high school, they were high school graduates, but we really couldn't even find where it said that they had to be a high school graduate anyplace. So we did have some students that would come in actually without a high school diploma. Sometimes they were working on a GED, but they actually didn't have a high school diploma. And we had some students come in that just had horrible high school records. So we said, God, you know, we gotta do something about this because you know, we don't want people here that aren't going to be successful. So what we instituted was a probationary program where they could come, anybody could come, but if they were in the bottom 20% of their high school class, or if they didn't have a high school diploma, they were admitted on probation. And that meant they had to get at least a C average their first 6 weeks, otherwise they were done. And that seems to have worked pretty well. And we also saw some students that were horrible students in high school and turned around and they got, you know, A's and B's here. You know, and I'd ask them, what's the difference? What happened? Well, number one, I'm really interested in the stuff I'm taking here because I got to pick what I wanted to take. Number two, I'm not going out and doing farm work all the time. I'm here on campus and I have a chance to do the work. A lot of the students would go home on the weekends, but, you know, most of them, you know, there was a few commuters, but most of them stayed mm-hmm. on campus. Mm-hmm. So I think, and in fact, one young man who was admitted on probation, I think, went on and got a master's degree. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's been some tremendous success stories of, mm-hmm. of people who this has opened up a new whole new world to them.
Right.
People that went on to veterinary school, people that went on and got bachelor's and master's degrees, a couple of them I know work for the university in various capacities yet today. So it's been enjoyable for me to see the progress of some of the students. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that I guess the day was, you might think you knew what you were going to do in a given day, but you didn't always get to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because some student would come in with some issue or problem, right. Or a house fellow would come in and say, I got this student who is depressed or whatever, right. And what are we going to do about him or her? You know, that, you know, there never was a dull moment, let's put it that way.
Was there some graduation or some end of...
Yes, they have a graduation. usually, well, this year it's going to be on March 23rd, and I am now relegated to being the pianist for the graduation, which is a lot easier. The parents and grandparents all come. It'll be in Union South here in Varsity Hall. Usually have a student speaker, and they have a faculty member that the students select to be a speaker. Students all march across the stage, receive their diploma cover. There's nothing in it at that stage yet, but I think it's a way of kind of closing out the year, and the parents seem to really enjoy coming here and getting on campus to see that. So it's worked out well. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, after that, you have to really find out, well, did they really graduate? Mm-hmm. And did they complete the courses needed for their specialty that they were working on, and that kind of thing.
Okay. So you retired in, 2007?
Yeah, I retired in 2007, and then a month later, I was hired back to do the short course one more year. So I actually got out of here in 2008, mm-hmm. in May. So I worked with the short course students one more year. So I actually had 25 complete years of directing the short course, which is the longest tenure of anybody that's ever done it. Previous person that had done it, 20, one person had done it 22 years, and the other person had done it for, 15 years. So most of the people have been fairly long tenured in that position.
I think you've alluded to this in some of your answers, but what do you think your legacy is then in the 25 years of short course?
Well, I think teaching or providing some structure and some discipline to the program, and good advice to a lot of students. I think I remember one young man coming up to me at the state fair a few years ago, and he said, "Do you remember me?" And I did remember him. He said, "Well, you know," he said, "I'm the guy." He said, "You did the best thing for me you ever could have done." He said, "I'm the guy that let some chickens loose once in Slichter Hall." It was all women's dorm at the time. And he had gotten them out of the poultry lab. And I said, "Come," when he was brought in to see me, I said, "How could you do this?" I said, you're a farm kid. You're in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. Here, a student has got these birds on a research trial of some sort, and you probably just ruined his research because you got them all worked up and excited and let them fly around inside of a dorm." "Oh, I never thought about that, you know." I said, "Well, you need to go down and see the chairman of the poultry science department and apologize to him and make sure that you can do anything possible to assist with the problem that you caused." And he went down there, and he was telling me this at the state fair. He said, "I talked to Dr. Sunday, and he just, he actually was really nice to me and said nothing had actually happened, but he would really appreciate it that I was concerned enough to come down and talk to him." He said, "You handled that the perfect way." He said, "I needed to have somebody chew me out, and you did it." And it was the best thing that happened to me in my life, So sometimes at the time, the kid thinks, "Oh, this is horrible, that I'm getting disciplined for something." But I think in the end, when several years pass by, they understand what's going on.
Right. Well, Rick, I want to thank you for your time again today. I appreciate it.